to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from Piglet, The Unexpected Story of a Deafblind Pink Puppy and His Family by Melissa Shapiro, veterinarian. And if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with Piglet by Melissa Shapiro, veterinarian. In our last reading, we learned that Melissa developed a Facebook page for Piglet. It attracts a number of viewers, which really surprised her. She also wrote ads seeking adoptive parents for the pink puppy. And now we turn to the latest writing, April 2017. Piglet has been with us a little over a month when Warren and I made the drive back to Milford Petco for a reunion with the pink puppy's rescuers from Colbert Veterinary Rescue Service, who had come to town for an adoption event with a new batch of their most recent rescues. Everything about this day and the circumstances surrounding it were in stark contrast to the March morning 5.5 weeks earlier when I had gone to pick up the hysterical baby Bart. The first time I'd driven by myself to go get the foster boy, it had been winter and the skies were ominous. By mid-April, we were enjoying a brisk and beautiful early spring. No longer hysterical, Piglet Bart was still prone, as I'd become fond of saying, to loud vocalizations. He still disliked going into his crate in the car, although we had made great strides in taming the dreaded crate monster for him by keeping a duplicate second crate in our tiny kitchen as his little eating cave. Associating the experience of being in a crate with eating, both in the kitchen for meals and in the car getting a cookie as soon as he was placed in the crate, had a symbiotic effect on Piglet that enabled him to accept each crate as a positive place to be. Until this day, I hadn't realized just how tied up in knots I had started to become. Strong feelings were completely at odds inside me. He was so much work. I couldn't keep him. But I was so attached to him. The thought of him staying killed me. The thought of him leaving killed me again. My sensible side grounded me. This was normal in some other situations. He was ready to thrive somewhere else. That was the deal. The thought of that inevitability caused a little stab in my heart, what must have been a worried expression. Warren picked up on my worry as we pulled into the parking lot outside the Milford Petco. Warren remarked, "Melissa, they are not going to believe how he has changed. You're a miracle worker. It's all because you set goals, realistic goals, that you both enjoy working to achieve." When I took Piglet out of the carrier and handed him to Warren, I did feel a wave of maternal pride. Piggy had filled out to over 2 pounds and had moved past the half-baked stage. Warren carried him into the store, tucked in the front of his jacket. With Piglet's pink face sticking out, his floppy ears waving in the wind, and roving pink nose inhaling the smell of spring. Would he remember the trauma of being here the last time? The answer came as Warren, Piglet, and I entered the Petco and went to say hi to Gloria. 5 weeks earlier, I'd grabbed the little screaming dragon and left so fast that we didn't even talk. This time, Piglet and Bart rode in, swathed in his favorite dad's jacketed arms, and the three of us were met by a beaming Dr. Gloria Andrews. Some of the same volunteers were there, all exchanging expressions of dubious surprise. Gloria petted Piggy now in Warren's hands, telling him how proud she was of him and how strong and handsome he'd become. My foster boy sniffed the air and wagged his tail happily in a way that hinted he recognized his special rescuer. Gloria beckoned us to follow her, saying as she went, "You've both done an amazing job with him. Thank you for everything you're doing to find the right home. Keep sending us potential candidates. Caroline is continuing to screen applications." The craziest mix of disappointment and relief fluttered through me. Warren heaved something close to me, and he said, "I told you so." Gloria let us know it looked like homes had been found for Piglet Bart's littermates after I'd listed him on the rescue group's page. LT, Barrett, deaf and mildly vision impaired, would be going to a home in Virginia where there were three other dogs and a cat, Josephine, Belinda, deaf and vision impaired, and Napoleon, Blaze, who was not a double dapple and could see and hear, were going to a home in Virginia as well. That's where there were many other dogs, not necessarily optimal. Gloria led us to a small pen where I recognized Abigail, Piglet's canine mom, a tan-colored chai doxy mix with a faint dapple pattern over her back. Abigail had been placed at the adoption event back in March, but soon after was returned due to behavioral issues. Ann Curcio, a longtime volunteer with Gloria's group and a devoted, capable organizer of other volunteers who helped oversee the adoption event, and organizers had been fostering Abigail since then. Abigail loved Anne and a brother dog in the household and so far had adapted beautifully. She had no disabilities but was wild and edgy, apparently as much as a character as Piglet. Anne mentioned that the rescue was still looking for placement for Abigail. "How can I ever think of giving her up?" I asked Anne. "She's so madly in love with you. If only I could have heard myself. Guilting foster parents about not adopting their foster dogs is disrespectful. As I well knew, fostering takes discipline and an understanding that the goal is to prepare a dog for a forever home. Maybe I was projecting in any case. Anne would end up adopting Abigail not long after our conversation. We entered the pen. Warren placed Piglety on the ground so he could connect to his dog mom without us forcing anything. Abigail approached tentatively. She had the same floppy ears and the same face as Piglet, though with big eyes and a brown button nose. I could see the signs of trauma, as she was wary of strangers. She looked closely at Piglet, a glimmer of recognition in her eyes, and then moved closer. The reaction for Piglet as she approached him was almost instantaneously. First he growled, "No tail wag." Then he barked, fiercely. He issued a warning, "Do not come any closer." Abigail stepped back. He obviously sensed that there was no reason to continue barking, so he stopped. Abigail wasn't in a definitive or defensive mode, but looked like she could enjoy a spat with her prodigal son. That is, if the situation arose. Piglet wasn't having any of it. He stepped back again, not bothering to waste his time, so that I could pick him up. He relaxed in my arms. The encounter was fascinating. Piglet knew who Abigail was. He definitely seemed to know that this was a mother who'd rejected him, and he did not like her. This same pattern would happen in other encounters when we brought the two together. Each time, Piglet recognized her, and while he carries on with his nasty boy grumbling, he eventually pipes down and then just ignores her. Of course, I had seen many reunions in the past, and this was not so unusual. I'd also seen the opposite in all kinds of animal families, where offspring hear, see, and smell their long-lost mothers and show them affection instantly, but not Piglet. "Interesting," I remarked to Warren as I held the pink puppy, confronted him, and followed Gloria to a quiet spot so we could talk about the ongoing search for Piglet's forever family. As we talked, Piglet cuddled up in my arms. Whatever was going to happen next, this moment told me explicitly that it wasn't going to be easy. I had to do the right thing. I just had to make sure I was what the right thing was. When Warren and I left the Milford Petco, that reality loomed over us like a massive storm, but neither one of us was willing to admit it. Gloria walked us out, thanking us profusely. "I'm so impressed. His progress is unbelievable." She had been so worried about Piggy's chances of even surviving. "Carolyn is working on some new applications, and one in particular looks good. We'll be in touch." Next week, we'll find out just exactly what happened with those applications. In Piglet, The Unexpected Story of a Deaf-Blind Pink Puppy and His Family by Melissa Shapiro, veterinarian. Our next reading comes from The Seeing Eye Guide, a magazine for friends of the seeing eye, Summer 2025 edition, Volume 91, Number 1. Breeding the best. Every seeing eye dog's journey begins with a spreadsheet. The guiding principle of the Seeing Eye, enhancing the independence and dignity of people who are blind through the use of Seeing Eye dogs, hasn't changed since 1929. But while the destination hasn't changed, we have made many advances in how we get there, explained Dr. Katie M. Evans, the Seeing Eye's Jane H. Booker Chair in Canine Genetics. As the Seeing Eye geneticist, Katie plays a part in every Seeing Eye partnership, even before birth. Katie, who was born and raised in England, holds a Bachelor of Veterinary Science from the University of Bristol, a Master of Science in Veterinary Epidemiology and Public Health and the Royal Veterinary College in London, and a Doctor of Philosophy in Quantitative Genetics from the University of Nottingham. She's also a member of the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons and holds a Certificate of Veterinary Anesthesia. She worked in clinical veterinary practice primarily as an anesthesiologist for 6 years, a career she's been thinking about since childhood. "I was dog obsessed, but my parents did not want a dog. I had to make do with cats, goldfish, hamsters, gerbils, rats. I have continually wondered if they had just relented and let me have a dog, whether my career might have gone a very different route," Katie said. "Like most British people of my age, I grew up watching All Creatures Great and Small on TV, based on the books of James Herriot. I think this might have been what made me want to be a veterinarian, although I don't remember that ever being my childhood ambition. And perhaps somewhere there was a bit of, no one can stop me having a dog once I'm a vet." Sure enough, Katie got her first dog, a border collie, soon after becoming a veterinarian. She became interested in epidemiology, then in genetics, after observing that dogs of a particular breed seem susceptible to certain conditions, and soon she was working on breeding and genetic projects for Guide Dog UK. That's the Animal Health Trust and the Kennel Club in London. In 2018, the Seeing Eye announced it was looking for a new geneticist. Katie said she was ready and was already familiar with the world's oldest guide dog organization. "I think it's impossible to work in the guide dog field, and probably even the wider service dog field, without being aware of the Seeing Eye. My PhD thesis includes a section on the history of the guide dog movement, which of course includes the story of the founding of the Seeing Eye and the pioneering work of Dr. Eldon Layton utilizing estimated breeding values in guide dog breeding. Here was also an inspiration and cited heavily. The Seeing Eye has long played a role as a pioneer, not just in guide dog training, but in genetics. In 1980, about 1 in 3 German shepherds were affected by hip dysplasia, thanks to the groundbreaking work in animal breeding and genetics begun by Dr. Layton and built upon by his successor, Dr. Emily Wade, and now by Katie. It has been nearly eliminated from our breeding colony. Advances in reducing hip dysplasia and other genetic conditions have enabled the Seeing Eye to produce only about 2.0 puppies for every needed as a guide or as a breeder. Few guide dog schools around the world can match that efficiency. The worldwide average, according to research by the International Working Dog Registry, is between 2.5 and 5.0 puppies. "It is my job to ensure that we produce enough dogs to supply the needs of instruction and training, and by extension our graduates, that those dogs are both healthy and temperamentally suited to be guide dogs." Katie not only needs to select dogs for the best health and behavioral traits, she has to maintain a healthy genetic diversity by limiting inbreeding by exchanging dogs with guide dog schools around the world. "We have an ever-increasing amount of information about our dogs, and in breeding terms, this means there's a lot that has to be taken into account, both when choosing which dogs will become breeders, and perhaps especially which dogs will be bred together. We have breeding, health screening results, behavioral measurements, and growth number of DNA test results, as well as the relationship between the dogs. There's a lot to think about and keep track of. It's a good thing that I still love a good spreadsheet." Katie also leads the Seeing Eye's many research projects with universities, veterinarians, and other guide dog programs. "It's a lovely thing that it's such a collaborative field. We can all learn from each other's experiences," she said. Last year, I was part of a two-expert panel advising on particular aspects of the updated International Guide Dog Federation standards, those relating to breeding, health, and welfare. I've also just become a member of the newly created IGDF, an Assistance Dogs International Dog Welfare and Ethics Advisory Panel. The Seeing Eye's current collaborative research projects include an investigation with the University of Georgia at Athens into the genetics of congenital idiopathic mesoesophagus in German Shepherds, a longstanding effort with Dr. Gus Aguirre at the University of Pennsylvania examines the genetics of canine eye issues. Two collaborations at Cornell University, one looking into the genetics of chronic superficial keratitis in German Shepherds, and another investigating the genetics of several specific conditions and also genomic selection modes. An investigation into the link between allostatic load, which are biomarkers for chronic stress, and success in guide dog training in Labrador retrievers. That's led by Colorado State University. Research takes time. Some of these projects began years before my arrival. Others we have begun during my tenure, but most are still going on. There are also other new research collaborations under discussion. I regularly attend guide and working dog conferences and also canine genetic conferences and almost always come back with business cards which lead to new projects. Looking ahead to the Seeing Eye's 100th anniversary in 2029 and beyond, Katie said it's difficult to predict what the future holds, but exciting possibilities are on the horizon, including the use of artificial intelligence to analyze the data. There are other health conditions which are part of current research collaborations for which I hope we might be able to definitively characterize the genetics. A couple of these look like they might be, well, single gene disorders. If this is the case, we could completely avoid producing affected dogs. For one in particular, I'm hoping we might get the answer this year. Others look more like complex conditions affected by multiple genes and also environmental factors. But one trait Katie hasn't had to breed for, cuteness with our puppies, that is guaranteed. This article appeared in the Seeing Eye Guide, a magazine for Friends of the Seeing Eye, Summer 2025, Volume 91, Number 1. Our next article is titled The Sky is the Limit, and it's from the Guide Dogs for the Blind. One of the foundational goals of Guide Dogs for the Blind's puppy raising program is for our volunteer puppy raisers to help rear confident, well-socialized puppies that have been exposed to a wide variety of real-world experiences that the pups may encounter if they become guide dogs. One important scenario is being familiar with air travel, whether that's the hustle and bustle of an airport terminal, the procedures of passing through a TSA checkpoint, or settling nicely in the cabin of an aircraft. Giving guide dog puppies these types of encounters when they are young can help set them up for success in their future careers. This past month, many of the puppy raisers and pups have been able to participate in specially designed airport settings to give them this type of socialization experience. In Portland, Oregon, the first excursion took place at the Portland International Airport, where local raisers walked with their pups through departure hall and passed through the security gate. Oregon's Fox 12 News shared a segment on the outing. San Luis Obispo, California. Next, we teamed up with our longtime partner, Alaska Airlines, for an activity at the San Luis Obispo County Airport. Raisers and puppies from throughout California's Central Coast had the opportunity to not only make their way through security and the terminal, but board an empty airplane as well. Pups learned to navigate the plane's aisle and settle into the footwell of the seats, all while taking in the sights and sounds of a mock takeoff. We are so grateful to Alaska Airlines and their commitment to supporting our mission by providing these types of experiences for our raisers and pups as well. Seattle, Washington. Completing the airport outing trifecta this month was an excursion to Seattle's Payne Field, where the airport's TSA staff held a mutually beneficial training session for its staff and approximately two dozen regional Guide Dog for the Blind puppy raisers and their puppies. During the experience, puppies got exposure to a moving baggage carousel and had the opportunity to pass through TSA screening areas. In addition, guide dogs for the blind client Chelsea Bowden, with her guide dog Harry, gave a short presentation about access and etiquette for people traveling with guide dogs. In addition to being an invaluable socialization experience for the raisers and the pups, it was a unique opportunity for the TSA staff as well by giving them hands-on training with screening service dogs and learning how to best support travelers who are visually impaired. We are thankful so much to our dedicated volunteer puppy raisers who generally donate their time and often travel long distances to participate in airport socialization outings, all in the service of preparing our puppies for greatness. If you're interested in becoming a volunteer puppy raiser, you can check it out at guidedogs.com/puppy to learn more. This article is titled "The Sky is the Limit," and it is written by Guide Dogs for the Blind. Our next article comes from Best Friends Magazine, July-August 2025 edition. "Together we can save them all" is the slogan for Best Friends. This article, "Chasing a Dream." Benton's adoption not only gave him a second chance, it helped his adopter accomplish her biggest running goal. Some finish lines are bigger than others. For Michelle Hood, a dedicated marathon runner, reaching the ultimate finish line wasn't just about completing the famous Tokyo Marathon. It was about the journey she took to get there, thanks to a very special dog. Benton was one of many animals taken in by the West Memphis Animal Shelter in West Memphis, Arkansas, after it was discovered that far more pets were living in a home in the area than the person could take care of. Large-scale cases like this can strain animal shelters' efforts to reach or maintain no-kill, and it takes many organizations working together to place those pets in homes. So Benton and nearly 30 other dogs and cats were welcomed at the Best Friends Pet Resource Center in Northwest Arkansas. Benton was shy and unsure of the world, but Michelle saw something special in him. "One look at him, and I had to adopt him," she says. "I knew he needed to be loved." Over time, Benton blossomed, learning what it meant to feel safe. As Benton settled into his new home, Michelle was chasing a dream of her own, completing the Abbott World Marathon, Major's Six Star, a series of six of the most prestigious marathons in the world. Only about 20,000 people globally have ever done it, and Michelle had just one race left, Tokyo. The problem, getting in, wasn't easy. She'd been trying for years through lotteries, virtual races, and essays, but luck wasn't on her side. That changed just 1 week after she adopted Benton. The Tokyo Marathon's charity application opened, and Michelle saw an opportunity. She applied to run for Peace Wins in Japan, a nonprofit dedicated to rescuing and rehoming pets, many of whom, like Benton, have come from heartbreaking situations. As part of her application, she wrote about Benton's journey, his resilience, and the love they had found. Her story struck a chord and was finally selected for the race. On March 2nd of this year, Michelle stood at the start line in Tokyo, running not just for herself, but for every animal who deserves a second chance. When she crossed the final finish line, she became one of only four people from Arkansas to complete all six marathons in the Abbott World Marathon Majors. "I owe all of this to my little buddy," Michelle says. Benton's adoption also set off a chain reaction, not just bringing him into a loving home, but inspiring Michelle to give back in a bigger way. She's now an active volunteer and member of Best Friends, helping dogs like Benton find their happy homes. This article is titled "Chasing a Dream," and it appeared in Best Friends Magazine, July-August 2025 edition. Continuing with Best Friends, here's a question to Holly. "I live on the fourth floor of an apartment building. My cat, Tansy, loves to go for walks off-leash at night. She's really, really good about it, always walking just a few feet in front of me, checking back to make sure I'm with her. We used to have overhead lights that cast a very soft orange-yellow glow on the walkways. Recently, maintenance replaced all of them with lights that are like fluorescent lights, very bright and very harsh. Ever since the new lights have been put up, Tansy absolutely refuses to walk more than a few feet from the front door, and then she sits down and stares up at the lights. I think it's really depressing her because the nightly walk was a big ritual that she really enjoyed, and now she won't participate at all. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions or if you have heard of anything like this before. I don't know what to do. She seems like such a little sad sack now. Signed, Concerned About My Sad Sack. Dear Concerned, first I suggest that you reach out to maintenance and or management to see if other residents have complained about the harshness of the new lights. If so, perhaps management would consider using a type of light filter in the lamps to soften the stark effect. Here are some other options. Ty distracting Tansy with treats while she explores and adjusts to the new lighting. Hold an umbrella over Tansy to diffuse the light as you walk. And finally, train her to wear a harness and walk on a leash. Then take her for walks in an area away from the bright lights. For details on how to train Tansy to walk comfortably on a leash, go to bestfriends.org and search for cat leash walks. With any luck, Tansy will soon be back to her old night owl, pardon me, cat, self. This article came from the Best Friends magazine, July-August 2025. And that completes our readings for today. I do hope you enjoyed them, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our life and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.